Tom Woods Show, episode 1420.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Folks, my away carry-on is everything I look for in a suitcase. It's lightweight, strong. It's got a really smooth glide through the airport. It's got a built-in combination lock, a compression system for overpackers like me, and a laundry bag to boot. Get $20 off a suitcase when you go to awaytravel.com/woods and use promo code WOODS during checkout. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. If you subscribe to my email newsletter, which I am always badgering you to do, which you can do, by the way, by visiting, let's say, how about yourfriendsarewrong.com. That's a really good ebook on healthcare and how it can be provided by the free market. Yourfriendsarewrong.com. Get you that ebook and get you on my list. Well, anyway, I sent out a note last week about something sad, a sad development, and that was the death of Murray Polner. Now, Murray and I collaborated on a book back in 2008 called We Who Dared to Say No to War, subtitle American Anti-War Writing from 1812 to Now. And it's a great collection, and I want to say a little something about it and about Murray himself and then get into more of the subject of left and right versus war. But what I said in the email was that we published this book together with Basic Books. It was reviewed very, very nicely. And the thing about it that made it unique was that Murray and I were on completely different sides of almost every issue other than war. Murray had spent his life in progressive circles. And of course, you know, I didn't. He was also involved in Jewish peace circles. He was the editor of Present Tense, published by the American Jewish Committee from 1973 to 1990. I believe he was the one and only editor of that publication. He was the author of numerous books. He was widely published in the popular press. He was an editor and content creator at History News Network until the day he died. But one of my favorite memories of Murray is that we're working on this book, and he told me one day that he was thinking, and there were a couple of wars in American history that he thought probably needed to be fought out, and how did I want to handle that? So I replied by saying that we would word our commentary in such a way that we would satisfy both our consciences and readers would know where each of us stood. But by the next day, Murray had called me up to say, screw it, let's include all the damn wars. And I'll just say, he didn't actually use the word screw. Used another word. Well, as recently as 3 years ago, at age 88, Murray contacted me to ask if I was interested in working on another book project. And I haven't wanted to do another book for some time now, but I thought that was tremendous to hear from him. He was a great man. He was a great fighter. Unlike many people we might identify as progressives, Murray was able to make careful distinctions. So he knew the difference between neoconservatives and the Ron Paul folks. It wasn't all just, you know, everybody to the right of Bob Dole is a Nazi. He was not a fan of Barack Obama because he was a progressive. And I would get these hysterical takes on the news from Murray in my inbox from time to time. And his tone of outrage was just so well formulated. And very often ended with him appealing to me to work on another book project. But as I say, I was a little bit booked out at that point. Now, in any event, I want to say a little something about the book that we did together. It's an anthology. Anthologies don't sell. My literary editor tried in vain, my literary agent, tried in vain to warn me that anthologies do not sell. But I said, well, this project is a labor of love for me anyway, so we're doing it. And it turned out, we found out later that Ralph Nader bought 1,200 copies of this book to distribute to people. So that was quite an interesting thing to find out about. Well, anyway, we each selected, let's say, speeches, book excerpts, poems, anything you can imagine, articles that we thought were some of the best, most incisive anti-war writing for all these wars. And we assembled them, we wrote little introductions to them, providing context. And the result, I think, was pretty darn good. The contributors are all over the map. So Daniel Webster, John Randolph, John Quincy Adams, Charles Sumner, Julia Ward Howe, Lysander Spooner, Stephen Crane, William Graham Sumner, William Jennings Bryan, Robert La Follette, Randolph Bourne, Helen Keller, Jeanette Rankin, David Dellinger, Robert Taft, Murray Rothbard, Russell Kirk, George McGovern, Philip and Daniel Berrigan, Butler Schaefer, Country Joe and the Fish, Andrew Basevich, Pat Buchanan, Bill Kaufman, Paul Craig Roberts, Howard Zinn, and Lou Rockwell. Pretty diverse. Now, I suppose you've probably never read Samuel Taggart's speech against the War of 1812. Well, neither had we. But the arguments Taggart had to answer have an eerily familiar ring. So, for example, the Canadians are terribly oppressed, and they're going to jump for joy when their American liberators arrive. I mean, that's the kind of thing he was dealing with. And if they don't jump for joy when their American liberators arrive, then they're a race of debased poltroons who deserve whatever American forces choose to shell out to them, the usual stuff. Our book consists of 70 selections, along with Butler Schaefer's list of great anti-war films, and I know you'll enjoy that. William Goodell tells the truth about the Mexican War, and Alexander Campbell makes one of the most compelling Christian arguments against war I've ever read. Anti-war abolitionists like Ezra Haywood and Lysander Spooner also have their say, as does Clement Vallandigham. He was the Ohio congressman who was exiled for his peace advocacy during the Civil War. Jeanette Rankin was the first woman to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives, and she was the only person to vote against American entry into both world wars, and so we feature her defense of both of those votes. If you've never actually read Randolph Bourne before, we associate him with the phrase, "War is the health of the state," then you're going to be blown away. And then more recently, we have a selection from Professor Andrew Basevich, who writes about losing his son in the Iraq War, and that was a war he himself had opposed for years. This, by the way, is the kind of book you can innocently give to a left liberal friend. It doesn't look like it's a libertarian book, and it doesn't look like you're stealthily trying to pass off a libertarian book on your friend. So bear that in mind. I would also add, there's one particular person whose selection really struck me. Most people have probably never heard of Elihu Burritt. I myself had not until this project came along. He was a 19th century writer, and he's more or less forgotten today, but he pointed out the great sympathy that the human race generally extends to people who've been the victims of misfortune, so famine or shipwreck or railway accidents or whatever. He then invited his readers to compare the feeling with which people greet the news of the loss or peril of a few human lives by accidents like these. Compare that to the way they receive the news of the death or mutilation of thousands of men on the field of battle. And here's his passage. How different is the valuation? How different in universal sympathy? War seems to reverse our best and boasted civilization, to carry back human society to the dark ages of barbarism, to cheapen the public appreciation of human life almost to the standard of brute beasts. And this demoralization of sentiment is not confined to the two or three nations engaged in war. It extends to the most distant and neutral nations. And they read of thousands slain or mangled in a single battle, with but a little more human sensibility than they would read the loss of so many pawns by a move on a chessboard. With what deep sympathy the American nation, even to the very slaves, heard of the suffering in Ireland by the potato famine. What shiploads of corn and provisions they sent over to relieve that suffering. But how little of that benevolent sympathy and of that generous aid would they have given to the same amount of suffering inflicted by war upon the people of a foreign country. This is one of the very worst works of war. It is not only the demoralization, but almost the transformation of human nature. We can generally ascertain how many lives have been lost in war. The tax gatherer lets us know how much money it costs. But no registry kept on earth can tell us how much is lost to the world by this insensibility to human suffering which a war produces in the whole family circle of nations. Now that's the kind of passage you want to resurrect. That's the kind of passage people should be reading again. The writings in this book are so moving, so wise, so devastating to the propaganda we've come to expect around war. These are the voices we rarely hear in history classrooms, which cannot seem to tear themselves away from the great war speeches of our heroic presidents. Now, I don't agree with everything in this book, and neither does Murray, but every single one of these selections is morally serious and worth reading. The classic oratory of war, the saccharine promises of war, the myths and propaganda that have driven war, all these things have enjoyed the spotlight long enough. The sane people deserve to have their say. And for 352 pages, they do. And incidentally, I will never earn another dime on this book. So this is not just a crummy pitch for royalties. I'm never going to earn anything else on this book. I'm going to link to the book on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1420. But before I go on, I want to read you guys something from my supporting listeners group, the Tom Woods Show Elite. I absolutely loved this. It was accompanied by photos as well. You've heard me say that my Away carry-on makes me the king of the airport because the thing has so many features and it's so lightweight yet durable and it's got these 360-degree spinner wheels and it's like it's floating on air. I absolutely love it. Well, I heard from somebody in my supporting listeners group who said this: I have to say, if you didn't believe Tom Woods about how great the Away suitcase is, here's some pictorial proof. Spending a couple weeks abroad in Europe and all I packed was this carry-on and a North Face backpack. And she goes on to note that the hotel, they found out, was a 20-minute walk from their train stop. Well, that's no problem. But then she realized that she had to go up an enormous hill and the route to the hotel was pretty much straight up. She says, these are not your typical USA roads. It's all cobblestone and crazy stairs. My entire trip so far has been streets like this, moving from place to place. She started in Vienna, then went to Poland, and then Portugal. And she says, this suitcase has seen the gamut. The wheels are taking it all like a champ, and no matter how many times I scrape it around and bash it up, I'm still queen of Europe over here. Thank you, Tom, for endorsing a great product. I highly recommend anyone in the market for a new carry-on take the leap and purchase this one. Worth every penny I spent. Now, how about that? You should pick up one too, either for yourself or as a gift for a friend or a loved one. And you can take $20 off a suitcase when you visit awaytravel.com/woods and use promo code WOODS during checkout. That's $20 off a suitcase at awaytravel.com/woods when you use promo code WOODS during checkout. All right, back to the episode. Now I want to do something that I have not done before. Murray was actually a guest on my podcast all the way back on episode 283. Now, I have some listeners who have been listening since episode 283. I have listeners who have been listening since episode 1, if you can believe that, every single episode. But I know there are a lot of people who never heard episode 283. And even if you did, given that I did that episode back in 2014, you might have forgotten a little bit of it. Let's just put it that way. This is the one time Murray Polner appeared on my program. And in honor of him, I would like to play for you episode 283 of The Tom Woods Show featuring guest Murray Polner. Rest in peace, my friend.
Welcome, everybody. It's Tuesday, November 11th, 2014. And on this Veterans Day, we're joined by Murray Polner, co-author with me of the book We Who Dared to Say No to War, American Anti-War Writing from 1812 to Now. Murray, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Tom.
I've had this show for over a year, Murray. I can't believe it took me this long. I'm such a blockhead to have you on. I've had so many people tell me how much they enjoyed the collection that you and I worked on, We Who Dared to Say No to War. And I remember when you and I met for lunch that day, I remember It was rainy. For some reason, I remember that distinctly.
It was one of New York's stormiest, Long Island's stormiest days.
Yeah, that's right. But doggone it, something bright.
I said, that kid better have something good for me.
Yeah, that's right. This better be worth it. And you know, it was not easy because sometimes we had to navigate copyright restrictions and, you know, what's in the public domain and what isn't. But by and large, I mean, we came up with a great collection of really great anti-war stuff from a diverse array of people. That's what made it exciting.
Yes. I saved every review. I'm sure you did, too. There wasn't a single negative review, not even in some of the much more right-wing, you know, hard-line, only in occasionally in a neocon publication that they have to put in a jab. But they're always bellicose, and they're always home-front warriors, so I never pay attention.
Yeah, I take that as a medal on my chest if they don't like what I do. But we even got a starred review from Publishers Weekly, which is hard to get.
That was super.
Yeah.
So,
I was really thrilled about that. Now, I want to talk about, obviously, I want to talk about the issue of war and so on and so forth, but I do want to start off talking a little bit about you. I gave people a little bit of your background and where you've written, but you've been involved in peace circles for, well, quite some time.
I did serve in the Naval Reserve, and I did serve on active military, Army duty, and so forth. But so I didn't get any lessons from that. But what I did was, I was always involved. I was, from the beginning, a member of the Jewish Peace Fellowship. But I also was primarily interested in finding, not pacifists, but alternatives to conflict and war. Yeah, I read Gandhi, and I read Thoreau, and I read Tolstoy, and all the rest. But I was trying to find an American kind of thing. Our book helped me because I found certain people I had never really thought about too much. But I was always interested, and primarily I was a writer. I did march on and anti-war things and so forth. But I wrote several books that brought me deeply into it. One of the books that I'm always proud of is No Victory Parade. I was teaching in a community college some 60 miles from New York City. And I never introduced the war into my history classes because I felt that was unfair to students. And I sure wasn't going to push my opinion. But I also organized concerned faculty against the war, which was all teachers after that, and faculty and professors. And then I did it in another, at a Catholic college that I taught. And therefore, I gave a talk against the war. And at the while I was in my office for the visiting, you know, the students come in at your office hours. Kid came in and he said, it's just been 2 or 3 weeks after, or 6 weeks, I think, as I remember, after he was in the Central Highlands in Vietnam. And he said to me, Professor, excuse me, but I think you're full of shit. And he defended the war. And then I talked to somebody else there who had been in the war. And the result was, I wrote No Victory Parade. I interviewed over 200 guys who had been in combat. And I also felt at the end what a lie the whole thing had been. As George Kennan famously said, what was our national interest in even going in there? And George Kennan was right at that point. And then I wrote many other things. I wrote, and all sorts of things. Right now, I'm working about 4 or 5 different publications. One of them that I really love is called the George Mason University has a website called History News Network, and its editor, Shankman, is a terrific guy, and it's a terrific website. And I write about them all the time. I have a blog and so forth. What I do is I used to speak a lot to different groups. I don't speak anymore, but I like to write, and it's great fun, aging and writing. What the book that we did, Tom, did for me, it was opened up even more things that I never knew. And I know America has been a trap of its own, set by the Washington Consensus, as I would say the great Andrew Bacevich and former Senator James Webb have been talking about recently. And that is, it's endless wars, no entry, no exit, and moving more and more, only wars that America should ever become involved in. That's what I've been writing about, are those that directly engage our national interest. Ukraine doesn't, Georgia didn't, of course, Iraq and Afghanistan didn't, and so forth and so on. And one of the things I've been doing is reading a great deal by, as I did in Vietnam and in World War II, reading a great deal about by the combatants themselves. An extraordinary number of volunteers, not draftees, because we wouldn't dare have a draft. Extraordinary number written about it. Recently, not long ago, last year, I had collected something like 10,000 or 15,000 books on Vietnam, and I donated them all free to Texas Tech University in Lubbock because they have the largest collection of Vietnam-era materials. And I want future generations to know what the hell we went through, and they went through. Another thing that triggered my interest was the murder of the Kent State kids. That's the one book that I regret not writing about, although I'm writing a piece again. I've written several pieces about. I never could find a smoking gun, but it was horrible, and so forth and so on. And then I wrote a book about, with my friend Jim O'Grady, who wrote a biography of the Berrigan brothers, the two priests that decided that Dan was more religious, Phil was more political, that were going to upset the apple cart, and based upon much of what Thomas Merton wrote, based upon their religious background, political background, Dorothy Day and the Catholic Worker, et cetera, they were an extraordinary group that I found very, very interesting. And then I worked in anti-draft movement and so forth and so on.
Murray, I want to go back to something you mentioned about yourself. I always wanted to ask you this, and somehow when we were working on the book, we were so busy, I was never able to do it. But I know about your involvement with the Jewish Peace Fellowship, and this must be, there must be a weird relationship between that kind of group and the neocons who believe
there
that
is.
If you're Jewish, there's
only— I don't
want
to go in now, but I'm a real critic of the current Israeli government. And I don't believe they're interested at all. Netanyahu has never been interested in allowing Palestinians to have their own sovereign, viable state. But yes, we were always outside it. But look, in the recent election, 69% of American Jews, the only white Americans that voted Democratic and kind of moderate liberal candidates. Jews have always been traditionally liberal. Of course, what American Jewish, the Jewish so-called Israel lobby does is they depend largely on the money of billionaires who are very conservative, you know, and so forth and so on. But so the Jewish Peace Fellowship started in 1941 by long before, I was a babe, but by a group of rabbis who felt that the numbers of Jews had been conscience objectors in World War II. Now, this is before news came out about the Holocaust. But even after, it was very difficult. A lot of their families abandoned them, and there was no one to support them. So what they did was, did what Quakers did, what the Mennonites did for their COs. They provided them with literature and visits, packages, and food, and so forth and so on. When I got in, I was beginning very active in the anti-draft movement in 1967 and 68, when I was teaching at various colleges. And, I look for also, because I'm very Jewish, and I'm very knowledgeable about my Jewish past, and I've written a book about the whole thing, and I've written all about my father and mother who lived through various pogroms and so forth and so on. So I decided that I wanted to find, as well as the secular group that I was with, find a Jewish group. So I found the Jewish Peace Fellowship. They were wonderful people. They were supported country. They didn't tell people to be a CO, but if they wanted to be, they told them the law, and then they supported them along the process. In fact, I have a lot of their documents I'm going to be submitting to the American Jewish Historical Society for futures to read.
Hang on, let me jump in for a second. I want to make sure people know that CO stands for conscientious objector. I mean, remember, we're dealing with a generation that doesn't know the draft, so they may not actually be familiar with this concept. Can you just take a minute to explain what the law was pertaining to conscientious objection?
Yeah, the last person, that poor sucker, poor guy, was drafted June 30, 1973. And the conscientious objectors initially said, America's been pretty good, except in World War One, they were terrible to conscientious objectors. From 27 to 37 people were sentenced to death, though no one ever died. And they sent them to long prison terms and so forth. Americans go crazy periodically. Alien and sedition laws, Red Scares, McCarthyism, and all that horrible neo-fascist crap, pardon me. But the conscientious objectors, America in World War II was better and generous, and in Vietnam, extremely generous, but the whole system was breaking down selective service. If originally it said that you had to have a religious orientation, it had to be a Quaker, traditional historical religious groups, Quakers, Mennonites, Amish, and so forth and so on. During the war, a guy, it was it must have been the ACLU people, they applied for, they objected to it. And therefore they added you had to have, not only you could have a religious objection or a very powerful ethical and moral objection to war. It couldn't be a particular war. It couldn't be a political instance. I don't like Bush, I don't like Obama, etc. That stuff had to be that you came from a world or you moved into a world that couldn't ethically, morally, or religiously support a war. And large numbers, increasing numbers of volunteers who joined after 9/11 have been discharged because they have since come to believe, or they had come since to believe, that war was not the answer for them. Well, they did not speak of the justice or right of the unjust and crazy invasion of Iraq, but they spoke about their feeling. And in many cases, the Defense Department accepted it. But they've learned that if you don't want to be in it, then let them go. They got honorable discharge. Incidentally, a cause that I'm trying to get interested in, the numbers of volunteers in those military got dishonorable discharges, often for very stupid, inane, trivial reasons. They're denied to this day, all the rights that a guy like me, who had an honorable discharge, get. It's a lot.
Well, that's interesting. I assumed there must have been a lot of people who were dishonorably discharged for reasons that were trivial. There's so many things I want to ask you, Murray, though, now that I have you on the phone here.
Write another book. That's what I wanted.
Yeah, I know. Look, that's you and I have the same answer to everything. just write another book, see what happens, float it out there, see where it goes. Did you think in 1989, 1990, 1991, as the Cold War wound down, did you think that this meant the warfare state would be scaled back, or did you feel like even then, I've been around the block too much, I know these people will find some pretext for it?
I hope that with the end of collapse of communism, that there would be a new approach, not only to the ex-Soviet Union, but a new approach to, without the nonsense about hegemony and global necessity of being involved and so forth. There were a few people that wanted to move in that direction, so-called national interest. You find them in their publications, national interest. They're all around. But I found that there were too many people invested in taking continued a hard line. So that you're talking about not only the neocons who love war, they'll never go and their kids never go, but you're talking about our merchants of death, producing constant flow of advanced killing machines. You're talking about our think tanks, our lobbyists, our producers of everything from uniforms to, to everything, our private contract. They're thinking of, by then, there were still people still married to the Cold War mentality. And I've written about, for example, in the Ukraine, Gorbachev was promised by Bush 1 that the United States would never support its puppet, NATO, moving close to their borders, which would be a direct threat, just like if they moved close to Mexico or into Cuba. And when they started to do that, he complained. And they said, well, it's only an oral, verbal statement. And of course, you see what happened in, almost happened in Georgia, certainly almost is happening in Ukraine. Yes, there were definite vested interests. It's very hard to break that mentality that we are one, USA, USA. And that's part of whatever's left of me to write about and to talk about is that we should only be involved when we're immediately, directly endangered. And that none of our current, and China, the future enemy, is not on my list.
Well, okay. nor on mine. Now, I want to know, as somebody who has spent his life on the left, but not as part of the liberal establishment, certainly, which has not been good on war, contrary to popular belief. How do you respond when you see "Ready for Hillary" bumper stickers? This must enrage you.
On my watch, I get a little nauseous at times.
Yeah.
I mean, she's a hawk, or she'll be a moderate hawk, like her husband, who evaded the draft, and then when he was president, of course, sent everybody bombers over Belgrade, over, and Kosovo and so forth. There's nothing like people, take John Kerry, for example, the man who made his famous statement, who should be the last person to die in Vietnam for a war like Vietnam, said that in the Senate. He was a hero for the Vietnam Veterans Against War. And yet he turned to the extent that when you get into power, you take on the coloration of power freak. You have to make all sorts of compromises, which is a very good argument again. So, in answer to your question, What was the question?
Well, I mean, how do you assess this popularity of Hillary?
I love to watch Bill Maher on his television sometimes. Last night, or Friday night, he was saying he hates the Republicans because they're all these homegrown warriors. But he said, most of them, I don't know, not Walter Jones or anything.
Right.
But he also said that the Democrats, by and large, are so weak. My last two congressmen, somebody said to me, let's form a picket line. This was during one of the Iraq war, out their offices. I said, they're so embedded, they're so involved, they're so pro-war. And even if they're not personally pro-war, my former congressman wrote me a letter. He said, well, he said, when I protested, he said, my wife disagrees with me, and I have two sons who are of age. And then when the war ended, you know, at least they more or less in Iraq, I wrote him a letter. He was out of office. He resigned. He retired. And I said, how long did your son serve in the military? Never got an answer.
Yeah, you know. Of course you didn't.
You know, these guys, Democrats, there are, it is a progressive. I must tell you, Democrats have a progressive bloc in the Congress. A lot of them, but they're not very powerful. Bernie, whatever his name was.
Bernie Sanders.
Sanders was on Bill Maher's. Very good. Doesn't stand a chance of help. Bill Greider quotes, what's his name? I forget. William Greider quotes in the latest Nation. He quotes Albert Hunt, an old hand, a wise old hand in the Washington Press Corps, whose wife is one of the lead announcers on NPR radio, TV. He said, Jim Hunt could be Hillary Clinton's worst nightmare. I don't know. She probably would. Who knows what will happen? I do know that over the years, let me put it this way, as a left winger, more or less, I become, quote, more and more libertarian in the sense that you and I agree of war and civil liberties and some of the heavy hand of people, not to say the federal government, but the way they operate. I wrote for a wonderful publication. I had a column. It just died, the newspaper, called New York. It was a watchdog on the New York Times, New York Times Examiner. And I wrote, for example, a series of articles on Obama, who I voted for twice. Second time, I regret it. Obama voted twice, though he's much better than the others. Obama, violation of civil liberties, and his attorney general, who's now retired, with their constant use of Woodrow Wilson's outrageous 1917 Espionage Act. You know that, Tom, that they have used, he has used more indictments under the Espionage than every president combined throughout our history. Even John Adams, when he had the Sedition Act, didn't do that. Well, he didn't have it, et cetera. And so, and he also has all this crazy little rule they put in that federal workers have to tell on, spy on their fellow workers if they hear something bad. I think of, you know, the old movies about the Nazis and the communists, you know, people spying on their parents. So to that extent, we have to be very, very careful. Federal government is necessary. It's not in that direction.
Well, I don't know if I'll be able to persuade you otherwise on that, but I'm glad you're going in that kind of direction, Murray. But now, look, I want to ask you this. It's Veterans Day today, and it seems to me that things are getting weirdly more idolatrous every year in the incredible reverence shown to and compliments heaped upon the heads of veterans. I don't know if there's a phenomenon quite like this elsewhere in the world. Veterans get discounts, special privileges. Every football game starts with some military celebration. It is everywhere. It suffuses the whole culture. Left and right have bought into it. You're on an airplane. There are soldiers on the plane. You're expected to clap. It is everywhere, because without the soldier, you'd be speaking German or whatever it is. What is your response to that?
Well, my response is twofold. One is, as a veteran, my wife still tells me to take out the garbage.
Good.
And my grandchildren call me Grandpa. However, I understand what they're doing. I agree with you. The over-militarization in the culture is impossible. It's drowning. I know a lot of veterans, and it's not only Vietnam, but also knew that some of the kids that went in and volunteered in Iraq. They think it's mad. They just live their lives. But this is one, it's like, remember those bumper stickers, support our troops? Somebody made a lot of money on that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, And what does that mean, support our troops? And secondly, there's a culture of militarism here that's come a crop. They haven't won a war since 1945, unless you count the glorious conquest of Grenada and Panama. There's a guilt complex. I don't know what it is. And liberals, they feel they have to join in, you know, the right wing, join in. What are they saluting? I wrote a letter. It never got published. They had I'm a great baseball fan, and I love the Mets. And they always have Wounded Warrior Day. And I wrote a letter to the Times sports page. They didn't publish. And I said, but they never mentioned why those guys were there wounded.
Yeah.
And what was the lie that brought them in? So I agree 1,000% of you. This is craziness that they have to go through. And this used to be called Armistice Day. And Armistice Day celebrated the end of another horrible, horrible 4 years of war, where some 60 million people were killed in the whole process, and 100,000 American soldiers were killed. And this is all forgotten.
Yeah, the change in emphasis is very clear and obvious.
And it's there's a very good article today's New York Times by a retired general. And he said, how do you define insanity? If you define insanity by doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting different results, then that's perfect definition of insanity.
Well, what did you think of that poll that found that most Americans supported the president's move against ISIS and most Americans didn't think it would work? That's insanity.
I know. It won't work. They do it. Just Americans, the hysteria over Ebola and the hysteria over this thing and that thing and ISIS. No one knows who ISIS is. Many of them came as a result of the failures in Iraq.
Yeah, and, no doubt.
And then, so they'll bomb and then so forth. You know, I just can't say. Americans, these polls are reflective of only the immediate headline. They ask complex questions or they frame questions that are favorable to the responses. So I dismiss them. They are very confusing and lazy, but they are. The best poll was when Kerry and Obama and maybe it came, I don't know who else on the Republican side, wanted to bomb, small bombing of Syria and support the rebels. No one who knew who the rebels were, of course. And surprisingly, the British Parliament said no, and surprisingly, the Americans said to their pollsters no. There's a certain point where Americans have a certain good sense, enough more of them, and most of us, and that is endless wars threaten everything, including their own children. The volunteer army simply means that Americans don't want their kids drafted. And they sold a bill of goods to these kids who joined the National Guard or reserves or came in because they had no other economic opportunities or they were bored as teenagers or whatever. You know, I mean, I remember enlisting in Naval Reserves. I didn't know what else to do. And it was a nice $10 check a month or something. So I think the polls are not confusing. Tomorrow's polls may be different. To get back to your basic question, after 1945, and especially when the war ended, and especially after the collapse of communism, it was a great opportunity. Gorbachev was the best Russian they would ever meet, and they failed. And because of whatever, all the interest, Washington, what's his name? I forget his name. He runs antiwar.com.
Justin Raimondo?
Yeah, he calls it the Imperial City. It really is the Imperial City. Cloistered, cut off from the rest of the segregated black city. Well, many middle and upper class blacks have joined, who were very well there.
And separated economically, too. They're all prospering. Their salaries are very high. Home values are high. They're doing great.
In America?
In D.C., in the Imperial City. They're all doing great.
Yeah, right. Not the poorest section.
Yeah, no. Well, listen, Murray, I'm thrilled to have had you on today and be able to talk to you about all this stuff. I want to make sure people follow your blogging activity over on the History News Network.
They go to Murray Pohner, and they type in, there's no there there.
Got it. Okay. And the spelling is P-O-L-N-E-R, Murray Pohner.
P-O-L-N-E-R.
Yes.
And take a look at the History News Network. It's a wonderful, it's not one point of view, it's many different points of view, but these are historians and journalists writing and arguing, and it's a lot of fun. And the editor is super.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed the History News Network myself. Well, Murray, thanks for talking to us on Veterans Day in particular. Your insights and conversation are deeply meaningful to me, and I appreciate it.
Stay in touch. And kiss all your 5 children for me.
I certainly will. Thanks, Murray.
All right, folks, before we wrap up for today, something I want to tell you about. I've mentioned a few times that I have actually a surprising number of would-be authors who listen, and I want to tell you that it's not hard to publish on Kindle, but it is hard if you're trying to figure it out all by yourself. So believe me, I know what I'm speaking about here. So I've actually put together a free video series that walks you through that. How do you publish on Kindle, and how do you promote a book on Kindle using all the different advantages they give you, all the different programs and possibilities to get publicity for your book that you may not know about. There are a lot of them. So I put together some free resources on this for those of you who are aspiring to do this, and that's at tomwoods.com/Kindle. And then secondly, please, 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 if you are in the NYC area, do please attend the New York City premiere of our documentary, The Housing Bubble, and it will be followed immediately by a panel that will be emceed by Liz Klayman of the Fox Business Network. She's on that program, Countdown to the Closing Bell, and featuring Peter Schiff, Gene Epstein, David Tice, and Jim Grant. It's going to be an amazing night out. You're definitely going to do that. So check out tomwoods.com/NYC, and I'll see you there.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.